Epilogue.
Sir, General Steuben's here. Mike leaned against the rock, looking out at the valley that had once been his home. He had seen the refugees and recon troopers extracted from the hole they had been huddling in, and then turned his back and left. That hole had been designed for the express purpose of keeping his daughter alive, and when she needed it, she hadn't been there. "Colonel O'Neill," the general said, touching his arm. "We're about to lift. We're needed in Europe." "Yes, sir," Mike replied, turning and holding out his hand. "Thank you for your help, sir." "You had the situation well in hand, as always." The suit turned and looked down across the valley and hills. In every direction there was nothing but an orange nothingness. The very soil had been stripped from the rocks. "I heard about your choice." "Yes, sir." His voice was cold and distant. "It was the right choice, Colonel. I don't know that I could have made it, but it was the right choice." "It would have been the right choice, but the timing. The Pasleen couldn't have forced their way through to the Cumberland," Mike stopped. "They couldn't have from the beginning, not with you on the way. You would have arrived before them." "But to Asheville?" the general asked quietly. 4 million civilians, Colonel. To overrun the Shiva? To wipe out another division of troops? Or two, or four, or five? And you could not know. It was clear that everything that was known to the Earth forces was known to the Pasleen. I don't know what they could have done if they had known. Perhaps there was nothing they could do. But this one, Tulos Stenelor, he was too smart. Who knows what he might have done? True, Mike sighed, but, oh God. He slumped down to the ground and curled into a ball. My daughter. The general looked at him for a moment and then sighed. I think Europe will wait, at least for me. He reached down and lifted the suit to its feet, taking the colonel by his shoulder and turning him towards the waiting shuttle. I think you and I, we will go get very drunk and cry for the death of a world.
This is absolutely unacceptable, the Tur shouted, then stopped panting.
I wonder if I could drive him into Linton time, Monsignor O'Reilly thought. No reason to change the plan. How is it unacceptable, my good Tyr, the Jesuit said aloud. Surely this is a day of rejoicing. In fact, through the doors to the conference room, much rejoicing could clearly be heard. O'Reilly thought he was probably the only person in the entire complex who was actually working. On the other hand, while getting the Pasleen off their backs was a good thing, to the Banshee it was just one step in a more complex war. Those forces were not to leave Irmansul uncovered, the Tyr said, firmly but back in control. There will be consequences. A fleet issue, I would think, O'Reilly said. As it has been reiterated many times before, the fleet does not belong to the United States or even Earth, but to the Federation. Any irregularities in unit dispositions is surely a Federation irregularity. The Monsignor smiled thinly, then made a complicated hand gesture. I would consider taking it up with your pet admirals, Tur. The United States government has all it can do to handle the sudden cessation of hostilities.
So you say, the Tur hissed. A fleet matter. Obviously the fleet needs to be brought to heel.
O'Reilly smiled darkly and shook his head. These Dar-Hell were so easy. What the hell had taken the Banshee this long to trip them up? That is surely your prerogative, Tur. But for now, there's a victory celebration, and I'm missing it. With that, the Jesuit rapped on the table with his knuckles, stood up, and went out to find a bottle of Busch Mills. Surely the Father Church would permit him one night of celebration. And tomorrow, it would be back to the wars. Of course, some people hadn't stopped. Tulu Stenelor blazed a trail through deep woods, showing his Ultos how to hack open a path. He didn't know why he bothered. The humans had taken control of the orbitals. Any ship that attempted to lift out was being destroyed. All that he could do was run and hide like an abat. It was humiliating. He snarled as the Ultos in the lead stopped and then reached for his rifle. Ahead in the clearing, there was a single Indawi standing alone. Stop, Tulo Stenelor said, waving the Ultos to lower their weapons. The green ones were never a threat. But what one was doing here at this time was an interesting question. He stepped forward and gestured at the little bean, but the Indawi just waved. You are Tulo Stenelor, First Order Battlemaster of the Stenpo Oslinar? The Indawi asked in Pasleen.
"I am," Tullor Sinilor replied, looking around. Suddenly the bushes in every direction spouted armed humans. They did nothing, though, just waited, their weapons bracketing his bodyguards. He waved at the Ultos to lower their weapons.
"Who are you?"
"I am the Indawi Elul," the little one said with a broad and toothy and very feral smile. "And I would like to make you an offer you can't refuse."
"So what do we do now?" Elgers asked the placement officer. The officer was short, overweight, balding, and apparently harassed, and clearly in no mood for handling troops that had misplaced their units. "For right now, I'll assign you to a BOQ room," the officer said, "and I'll put the two NCOs in the NCOs' quarters. Then I'll send a memo up to DA asking them what the hell to do with you. Until we find out, just stick around the area." He handed each of them a slip of paper and waved at the door. "This seems... I don't know," Elgar said as they walked down the corridor. The Asheville Corps headquarters seemed to have completely lost its head. With the return of the fleet, half the soldiers expected to be out-processed immediately, and all the little routines were gone. Suddenly, no one knew what the future would hold. In a way, it was better facing the Pozzoline. "Abrupt," Masovich said, holding the door open for her in a gesture that was chivalrous rather than rank-based. "When you work odd jobs, you get used to it. Every now and again you get a heap of thanks. Usually you just get ignored. The difficulty of the mission, or how well you did, rarely seems to have anything to do with the outcome."
"What now, boss?" Mueller said.
"Well, if the captain can be seen slumming with a couple of enlisted pukes, I suggest we find a bar and get really drunk," the sergeant major replied.
"Good idea," Elgar said, looking towards the gates of the compound. "Follow me."
Mueller chuckled as they headed out, the two males having to work to match her stride. "You seem to be more whole these days."
"I feel whole," Elgers replied with a smile. "I haven't had a personality pop up in a few days. Everything feels integrated. As if, for the first time I awoke, I'm myself."
"And do you know who you are?" Masovich asked carefully.
"Yep."
"Who?"
"Anne Elgers," she said in a definite tone.
"Just Anne."
"Must come as a surprise in the morning, huh?" Mueller said with a laugh. Masovich shook his head and looked at the woman for a moment, then sighed as if for the death of a friend.
"Yep, time for us to get stinking drunk, ma'am."
Colonel Garcia got out of the personnel elevator, shaking his head like a doctor about to tell the family that little Timmy wasn't going to be coming home.
"There's not much we can do, Colonel," he said to Mitchell, looking around at the group. The whole Shiva crew, plus Kilzer and Major Chan, had gathered to hear the news.
"The engineering area is covered in pebbles," he continued. "It's as hot as I've ever seen. Then there's the battle damage. Given that most of the Shivas are going to be decommissioned, it will probably be left right here. We'll pull the metal storms off and anything else that is salvageable, decommission the main gun, and then seal it up with a bunch of radiation warnings all over it. This whole area is hot enough, it will probably be closed anyway."
Mitchell nodded and sighed, looking around at the devastated landscape.
"I hope for better, but..." He looked up at the mountain of metal that had been their home for the last few days and shook his head. "What now?"
"Get some rest," the repair commander said.
"Will do," Mitchell replied. He looked at Indy and Chan and then shrugged.
"Ladies, I do believe there's an officers' club in Asheville that is calling our names. Can you buy a ladies a drink? I'm sure we can bum a ride."
"Hey, what about us?" Pruitt asked, gesturing at Reeves. "You're just going to walk off into the sunset with the girls and leave us in the middle of a radioactive wasteland?"
"Pruitt, an officer's first duty is to his men," Mitchell replied solemnly, holding his arm out on either side to the warrant and the major. "You and Reeves have a 4-day pass. Report to the 147th G1 in 4 days. Don't drink and drive. This completes your pre-pass safety briefing. Have fun." With that, he turned around and started walking towards the nearby vehicle park.
"Well, that sucks," Reeves growled. "Where the hell are we supposed to go?"
"After them," Pruitt said, spotting Major LeBlanc striding up the hill.
"As fast as we can."
Kilzer spotted her at about the same time and looked around wildly. She was between him and the vehicles, and going back into the Shiva without a rad suit was suicide. But he considered it for just a moment. He suspected he was going to lose his balls anyway. Might as well be to some more or less painless radiation damage.
"Mr. Kilzer," the major said, walking up to him and planting both fists on her hips. "A moment of your time."
"Yes, ma'am," Paul said. LeBlanc looked down to where his hands had just naturally fallen to protect his groin.
"I'm not going to kick you in the balls," she said with a shake of her head. Then when he smiled and moved his hands aside, she did exactly that. "Oh!" she cried, kicking him again as he rolled around on the ground. "I'm sorry! My mistake! I meant to say I am going to kick you in the balls. I don't know how that knot got in there. Maybe a side effect of radiation poisoning?"
"Oh, I'm sorry. It was a mistake."
"Yeah, I know you are. Sorry, that is." LeBlanc stepped back and shook her head. "Get up. You look like a baby down there whining and clutching your privates in pain."
"Oh, are you going to kick me again?" Kilzer groaned.
"Are you going to be an ignorant asshole again?"
"Oh, shit.
Get up and I'll let you buy me a drink." "You're really not going to kick me again?" Kilzer said, getting painfully to what he promised. "Not unless you screw up again."
"Damn.
We have to quit meeting like this," Wendy said softly. "You've only seen me, what, once before in the body and fender shop?" Tommy said from inside the tank. He was fully submerged in a red solution, but a bubble of air was open around his mouth and nose. He grinned through the nanite solution and pointed to where a darker, more opaque cloud was worrying about his shoulder. "Hey, if only they could increase the size of my cock."
"You don't need that," Wendy said, looking at the tank and suddenly seeing it as old technology. It was practically magic to most people, able to regrow limbs and heal almost any wound short of death. But she had seen real magic, for which even death was not an impossible barrier, and she really wondered what in the hell was going to happen when someone figured out what she knew. The world was already a very dangerous place. She didn't need non-random enemies.
"I'll be out in a couple of days," Tommy said, when she seemed to have drifted off. "I'll have some leave coming, and with the fleet back, well, I'm not sure what they're going to do in the way of forces. Anyway, I was wondering, you want to get married?"
She looked at her boyfriend and shook her head. "You can't kneel in that condition, and it would be hard to hold out the box and then put the ring on my finger. So, under the circumstances, I'll accept the method of proposal," she said with a broad grin.
"Great! What about the fleet? What are they going to say?"
"Fuck 'em. What are they going to do, send me on a suicide mission?"
"Not any more, love," Wendy said quietly. "No more."
"Well, I've got to do something," Tommy said in a worried tone. "They're talking about cutting back the fleet and even fleet strike. I might be a discharged lieutenant with no training and no future. That wouldn't be fun to be married to."
"We'll cross that bridge when or if we come to it," Wendy said.
"But I'd be just as glad if you weren't working for fleet, to tell you the truth."
"Well, I've got to do something." "I'm still trying to get straight if you guys are white hats or black hats," Papa O'Neill said, taking a sip of coffee. The meeting room was apparently deep underground. Now that he had seen what a Hemet ship could do to rock, he was not surprised. What he had been surprised was by the briefer. "The Banshee would, I think, qualify as white hats," Monsignor O'Reilly said quietly. "You'll be told of our history and background. You, of course, understand the term need to know. You will be told what you need to know. For the rest, well, we're the people who saved you. We have done favors for your son as well. This is in our interest, you understand. Michael O'Neill is one of several possible paths to victory over the true enemy in this war, and it is for that we saved you, in the hope of recruiting you to this great task." "Uh-huh," Callie said. She had a Coke in her hand, but so far she hadn't touched it.
"Who is the real enemy, then?"
"The Dar-Hell, of course," O'Reilly said. "It is they who waited until the last minute to warn Earth. It is they that, when it was apparent humans were going to be even more inventive than they gave them credit for, slowed production of essential war materials both off-planet and on Earth. They have supplied the Pozzlene with critical intelligence, without the Pozzlene's knowledge, by the way. On a personal note, they forced the choice of commanders on dice that nearly got your father killed, hacked the 10th Corps data net, and did various other things, including sending an assassin after you when you were 8 to make your life less pleasant than it could have been. The only personal loss that is not directly attributable to them is the loss of your mother. Random chance does play a role in war. And even there, she should have been in command of a cruiser, not stuck with a half-finished, poorly constructed, poorly designed frigate. This, too, could be laid at the door of the Dar-Hell."
"And we can believe as much of that as we like," Papa replied.
"We'll give you some bona fides eventually," O'Reilly said dryly.
I think that after you get to know us, the truth will become obvious, and the appearance of Michael O'Neill, Sr., or Callie O'Neill will be cause for some comment, given that they are presumed most thoroughly dead."
"I doubt that telling them the truth would be a good idea, huh?" Callie said.
"Not particularly. The Terran authorities would take you for nuts, and the Darhel would have you silenced in very short order. We have a need for well-trained, highly motivated, and self-directing special operations experts. You, Mr. O'Neill, have a long track record of such things, and Team Conyers was most impressed on their brief visit."
"I wondered when that was going to come up," O'Neill said, nodding.
"And with the exception of the experience part, the same goes for Miss O'Neill. If nothing else, the Banshee have been, from time immemorial, believers that blood tells. And you are of the finest stock imaginable. I cannot imagine you failing to be a fine operative, can you?"
"No," Callie said with a grin and a shrug, finally taking a sip of the Coke.
"Both of you have a need, new identities, new lives, and, trust me, protection in that anonymity. If the Darhel got wind you were alive, we have a need, and you are two of the best examples of a round peg in a round hole I have seen in quite some time."
Callie sighed. "What the hell? I'm in, as long as the missions make sense."
"You won't need to worry about missions for a while, young lady," the Monsignor replied. "You've got quite a bit of schooling of all sorts ahead of you."
"School?" Callie asked again. "You're joking, right?"
"No, he's not," Papa O'Neill snapped. "You need to get an education. Even if you're doing this, whatever it is, for the long haul, you still need an education."
"School," Callie groaned. "Great, I bet they'll take away all my guns."
"Only to put them in an armory," O'Reilly said with a smile. "As I said, of all sorts. Just try not to kill any of the nuns."
"Better and better nuns," but she nodded. "As long as they don't bang my fingers with rulers, I'll let them live."
"Okay, Callie's taken care of," Papa O'Neill said with a frown, staring at the priest. "And I'll come on board, too. I'll hunt your she for you. I'll be the best darn hunter of she you've got. A fucking wild hunt all on my own self." He paused and flexed his jaw as if preparing for a fight. "But I have one condition." Shari stood in the line of refugees, waiting in another drizzling cold rain to get processed into the Knoxville tent city. Most of the children had already been taken away by social services. After all that sweat and all that suffering and all that fear, they had just been whisked away with a disapproving snarl, as if it were her fault that they had been in the damned herb or gotten into the middle of a nuclear war. At least they were alive, unlike, God, everyone. Wendy had gone to the hospital to see her boyfriend, and Masovich and Mueller had disappeared to wherever it was the troopers go after the fight, leaving her with just Billy and Kelly and Susie, and another tent city, another batch of frightened, shell-shocked strangers. Another beginning. She squished forward a few more steps, holding on to Kelly and Susie's hands and keeping one eye on Billy. He seemed better since the whole episode, as if reliving the nightmares had somehow cleansed him instead of making him worse. He probably would do fine. It would have been better if... It would have been better if the Posleen had never come. It would have been better if Fredericksburg had never been destroyed. It would have been better if 2 million people hadn't died in the herb, or 5 billion scattered across the globe. So thinking that it would have been better if one worn-out old man had not died was just...
"Hey, lady, want to dance?"
a voice whispered in her ear. She spun in place, furious, and let go of Kelly to slap the ignorant, pig-headed bastard across the face, but stopped, arrested by his eyes.
"You look like you've seen a ghost," the stranger said, smiling and holding out his hands.
He was a little too tall and far too young, and his hair was fiery red and long instead of short, thinning, and gray. But there was something about the eyes, about the cheekbones, something about the huge wad of chewing tobacco in his cheek.
"Pity," he said, taking her hands and starting his way. "I heard you like to dance."
"It's a marvelous night for a moon dance, with the stars up above in your eyes."
Shari didn't know how she found him through the tears, but she managed to get her arms around him, and after that, everything was going to be okay. Somehow, beyond hope, beyond reason, it would all be okay.